Welcome back to the second half of Earth First Radio. I'm Uncle Dennis, and there's more important information coming up, so please keep a pencil and some recycled paper handy. And as I usually do right here at the beginning of the second half of the show, we do our commentary, and this week's commentary is called Big Timber's Big Lies. They'll say whatever it takes to keep the subsidies rolling in. And this is a guide to countering timber industry propaganda. Let's see, who wrote this? It's written by Chad Hansen, National Director of the Sierra Club, and Executive Director of the John Muir Project. And we'll get his contact information a little later on. Chad's a great guy. Here it is. A decade ago, my brother and I fulfilled a lifelong dream of hiking from Mexico to Canada on the 2,700-mile Pacific Crest Trail, most of which traverses national forests in the Pacific Coast states. We fully expected to see great expanses of wilderness, unbroken and unspoiled, and we did, until we reached the northern Sierra Nevada. There we began to notice Forest Service signs posted on trees along the trail that read, "Trail washed out, take detour." We dutifully obeyed and slogged along the hastily hacked out paths. Then one day, in the Tahoe National Forest, we noticed two men up ahead writing on one of these signs. When they saw us, they hustled up the trail and out of sight. Their words in fresh marker pen ink warned, "Clear cuts ahead, it's a scam." Intrigued, we stuck to the main trail and soon found ourselves staring across a massive clear cut that extended over the ridgeline. Attempts to replant had obviously been made, but the topsoil had washed away and the saplings were dead. Not one living thing could be seen. Catching up to the signs editors, we were amazed to learn that they were the U.S. Forest Service employees who had put up the original warnings. Their bosses had ordered them to do this, they said, in a cynical attempt to conceal the devastating effects of commercial logging. This was not the last clear cut. From the northern Sierra up through the Marble Mountains and the Cascades, we encountered one stump field after another, along with reforestation plantings of tidy rows of little trees, all of the same species. I had never before been politically involved, but by the time we reached the Canadian border 5 months and 4 days after setting out, I was a convert to forest activism. I began to investigate the Forest Service and the timber industry in an effort to answer the question that kept reoccurring as we walked through the devastation: why are they logging our national forests? You sure hear the money tinkling right there. The main reason is that we're paying them to do it. The Forest Service's own figures reveal that timber sales program on our national forests operates at a net loss to the taxpayers of well over $1 billion each year. Not only does the industry get a sweet deal on the trees themselves, but a substantial chunk of its overhead is free, courtesy of the U.S. taxpayer. We pick up the tab for logging road construction, timber sale planning and administrative costs, replanting, and even restoration and cleanup. But this isn't certainly not the explanation you'll hear from the industry or the Forest Service. According to them, logging provides jobs, offers fire protection, improves forest health, supports rural education, and prevents deforestation in other parts of the world. A closer examination, however, reveals that all of these claims are merely deceptive ploys used to justify continued destruction of our national forests. Clear-cutting jobs? The National Forest and the timber industry claim that logging our public lands is essential for jobs and the economy, but the agency's own documents show that recreation in national forests contributes over 31 times more to the U.S. economy and creates 38 times more jobs than logging national forests. If we ended all commercial logging on national forests and redirected the subsidies into timber community assistance, we could pay each public lands timber worker more than $30,000 a year for job retraining or ecological restoration work, and still save taxpayers millions of dollars. From 1979 to 1989, a period of extremely heavy logging on Northwest Federal Forest Timber employment actually fell by about 20,000. The main cause of job loss was not environmental regulations, as the timber industry would have us believe, but automation and the loss of old-growth forests due to logging itself. But logging isn't even done by loggers anymore. Enormous mechanical monsters known as feller bunchers roam the forest floor. A huge hydraulic clamp grasps the trunk of the tree with startling quickness and massively shear cuts through it in one swift motion. The clamp then sets the tree aside and the monster machine rolls forward through the forest. It is tireless. It never complains about wages or working conditions. Its hunger for our trees knows no limit. Given this technology, it is not surprising that 10 years ago, the U.S. General Accounting Office projected that even if logging on national forests increased by 55% over the next 50 years, employment in timber extraction and milling would still drop by more than 25%. Logging the forest to save them? I don't think so. As the truth about logging and economics was increasingly exposed by forest activists in the 90s, the industry faced a public relations crisis. The old jobs versus the environment rhetoric just didn't hold up, so new, ostensibly altruistic justifications were invented. The industry now insists that we must cut the trees to protect them from fire and disease, yet the Forest Service's own 1994 study, Forest Resources of the United States, reveals that tree mortality in the West due to both fire and disease actually increases in logged areas. The worst rates were on private timberlands, where logging levels were even higher and where less natural forest remains. In western forests, from 1986 to 1991, tree mortality from fire and disease on private lands went up by 20% compared to 3% on national forests, while it actually decreased by 9% on other public lands such as national parks. Fires tend to start in areas that have been logged because logged forests are drier, less shaded, and contain flammable debris known as slash piles, unmerchantable branches left over by logging crews. When fires do occur in old-growth forests, they rarely kill the larger trees, which have thick, fire-resistant bark. Instead, such fires simply clear away understory brush and return nutrients to the soil, enhancing forest health. Even in relatively rare event that a fire does kill an old-growth stand, the remaining trees and snags provide valuable nesting habitat for large birds of prey and other forest species. Wildlife has little use for stumps. In 1993, the Forest Service introduced a new logging program, Forest Stewardship, that is purportedly conducted for the health of the forest. As public opinion polls in the mid-90s began to show that a growing majority of Americans wanted to end federal timber sales, the Forest Service countered by reducing the volume cut under its timber commodity program and making up the difference with a steady increase in logging under the Forest Stewardship Program. Today, roughly half of all timber cut on national forests is supposedly for the forest's own good. Most of the biggest, most destructive timber sales, including massive clear cuts through ancient forests and roadless areas, are planned, prepared, and executed under the guise of stewardship. Most of those are supposedly carried out to reduce fire risk. Last year, however, the General Accounting Office report finally called into serious question the use of timber sales to address fire issues. Most of the trees that need to be removed to reduce accumulated fuels are small in diameter and have little or no commercial value, the report noted. Because of this, Forest Service managers tend to focus on areas with high-value commercial timber rather than on areas with high fire hazards and include more large commercially valuable trees in a sale than are necessary to reduce the accumulated fuels. The GAO concluded that the program is, quote, largely driven by commercial rather than safety considerations, unquote. Indeed, the principal methods for setting the Forest Service's fire reduction budget are commercial. The cover of the technical course manual of the Forest Service's National Fire Management Analysis System shows a balancing scale. On its right side is a stand of trees on fire. On the left is a large bag of money. The text openly states the NMAS presently has no provision for directly and systematically estimating the economic impact of effects of fire on wildland resource values that do not in and of themselves produce market or commodity outputs. The message is clear. If it can't be sold, it doesn't have values. Big Timber's Big Lies, 1 and 2. Here's the first one. Clear cuts for kids. In addition to pretending to be a crusader for forest health, the timber industry has cast itself as a savior of rural education. This ruse is made possible by a federal law enacted nearly a century ago requiring that 25% of timber sale revenues from national forests go to rural counties for road maintenance and education. The result is that school systems have gotten hooked on revenue from deforestation, and fluctuations in the timber economy have made school budgets unpredictable. Both the Clinton administration and the Forest Service have proposed legislation to delink education funding from sales and make guaranteed payments for schools directly from the government. The timber industry is vehemently opposed to such a move, but they lost. Under heavy timber industry pressure, the White House passed H.R. 2389, the Secure Rural Schools and Community Self-Determination Act, which keeps rural education dependent on public lands deforestation. At press time, an equally destructive companion bill, S-1608, was under consideration by the Senate. The bills would set county payments at fixed levels, but would raid funds from non-timber programs such as Fish and Wildlife if timber revenue wasn't sufficient, putting pressure on agency managers to get the cutout. The bills also require a substantial portion of the payments to be used not for education, but rather for additional logging projects on national forests. And logging as foreign policy. As if the rationalization about jobs, forest health, fire protection, and education weren't hard enough to swallow, timber executives and their friends in Congress are now insisting that halting logging on our national forests would create shifting economic pressures to increase logging on forests abroad. Forest protection at home, they now argue, triggers deforestation elsewhere. In fact, less than 3% of domestic wood comes from national forests. Even if industry's contentions about worldwide logging were true, any shift in supply would have a minute effect on the overall global timber harvest. What's more, the industry's own research provides little support for the shifting pressures rhetoric. A recent study in the American Journal of Agricultural Economics estimates that for every 50 acres of forest protected in North America and Europe, only 2.5 acres of forest would be lost collectively throughout Asia, North America, Africa, and the former Soviet Union. That's a pretty big ratio there. And this study doesn't address the extent to which a shift to non-wood alternatives would compensate for reduced domestic logging. This shift in supply could well go in an entirely different direction rather than timber industry would have us believe, not to foreign countries, but to substitutes for wood. Ending timber sales on national forests and removing heavily subsidized public timber from the market would enable a non-wood product to be more competitive. For example, overall costs of building with recycled light-gauge steel are only 3% greater than those of wood, but even such a small difference causes contractors to choose wood framing. If not for the unfairly low prices created by the federal timber program, says Michael Roddy, president of Green Framing Systems, recycled steel can meet significantly more of the demand for construction materials. In any case, the timber industry's predictions of rising wood demand have turned out to be wishful thinking. Earlier reports incorrectly projected that by the year 2000, wood consumption would be 70% higher than it now is. Global consumption of wood in 1998 was actually about the same as in 1984, having peaked in the late 80s and decreased slightly since then. Probably mostly due to rising prices, predictions that the demand for wood can only be met by continuing or increasing logging assume no increase in recycling or development of alternatives. Yet there is not so much demand for wood itself as a demand for paper and construction products, products that can easily be derived from non-forest sources and recycled materials. The federal government, the single largest consumer of paper in the world, provides an example of the potential for change. The executive branch alone consumes 20.9 billion pages of copy paper each year. Although federal agencies have increased the recycled content of their copy paper in the last 2 years thanks to an administrative mandate, over two-thirds of it is still derived from virgin wood fiber. Executive Order 13101 required suppliers to provide paper with at least 30% post-consumer recycled content. When it was proposed, paper manufacturers howled, insisting that they could not meet such a requirement. Nevertheless, only 2 years later, suppliers have adjusted and federal agencies are now 95% in compliance. The quantity of paper consumed by judicial and legislative branches of the federal government is unknown, but if they use as much as the executive branch, then the federal government's total consumption would roughly equal the amount of paper produced through commercial logging on national forests annually. More than one-third of the timber cut on national forests from 150 to 250,000 acres each year goes into paper products. Stronger recycling efforts could greatly reduce the need for lumber. Figures released last year by the Forest Service's Forest Products Lab in Madison, Wisconsin, show that 29.6 million tons of recoverable, usable waste wood is produced in the United States each year from three major sources: municipal solid waste, demolition and construction waste, and the timber milling process. This is the equivalent of over 45 billion board feet, that's with a B, nearly half of all the wood consumed in the United States each year, and 15 times the amount of timber cut from national forests annually. Every year, this quantity of wood ends up in landfills. What's the real global issue? Logging on our national forests does have a global impact, but it's the exact opposite of what the timber industry alleges. The United States, for better or worse, is the trendsetter in international policies affecting forests. For example, the United States was widely blamed by conservationists for the failure of the 1992 Environmental Summit in Rio de Janeiro to deliver a meaningful forest protection treaty. Less developed nations pointed out that the United States is still logging its last remaining ancient forests even on public lands. Why then, they argued, should they institute strong measures to preserve their own forests? Forest protection begets forest protection. Halting logging on federal lands would encourage preservation on both U.S. private lands and forests abroad. According to Mauricio Fierro of GeoAustral, the Chilean Forest Protection Organization, quote, as much as we appreciate direct support from people in the United States, the most helpful things you could do for us would be to stop logging your own national forests. Quote, similarly, Chris Giovalli of the British Columbia-based Rain Coast Conservation Society says, quote, ending logging on U.S. national forest land will set an immediate and important precedent for ancient forest protection and will create positive political momentum internationally, which in turn could end up helping forest protection efforts in British Columbia, unquote. As citizens of this country, we are faced with a choice. We can, through our silence, allow the timber industry to continue picking our pockets and plundering our public forests. Or we can hold our elected officials accountable and demand that they end timber sale programs on our national forests. And Uncle Dennis agrees. This was written by Chad Hansen, the national director of the Sierra Club and executive director of the John Muir Project. His phone number is 626-792-0109. That's 626-792-0109. Or you can write to Chad at Chad Hansen, C-H-A-D-H-A-N-S-O-N, at juno.com. We thank Chad, longtime environmentalist, for that wonderful editorial. And moving back to announcements, the Mattaponi Indian tribe calls for campaigns and ceremonies against a proposed reservoir in Virginia. The Mattaponi Indian tribe has called for a month-long campaign in opposition to a proposed reservoir, culminating in a ceremony at the Bell Tower on the Capitol Square in Richmond, Virginia, on February 9th. And this campaign is going on every Monday. The King William Reservoir had been rejected by the Army Corps of Engineers as well as four independent government and private studies on the basis of what the city of Newport News, which requested the construction of the dam, does not need the water it would produce. In addition, the Corps found that the reservoir would flood 437 acres of wetlands, more than Virginia has lost at any one time since the passage of the Clean Water Act, and would endanger two federally listed species of plants. It would also do irreparable harm to the Mattaponi culture, permanently ending the subsistence shad fishing the tribe has practiced continuously for 15,000 years and flooding over 70 documented archaeological sites. Finally, the reservoir would violate a 1677 treaty between the Commonwealth of Virginia and the tribe, guaranteeing a 3-mile buffer zone around Mattaponi lands. However, the Corps had been unable to permanently table the project because of the support it had received from Virginia Governor Jim Gilmore. The Mattaponi Indian Tribe and several organizations supporting it have outlined a month-long campaign featuring actions on successive Mondays to voice their displeasure over Gilmore's support of the reservoir. The main action on Monday, February 19th, will feature the Mattaponi and their supporters gathering at the Bell Tower on the Capitol Square in Richmond, Virginia at 1:30 p.m. The ceremony is expected to include Mattaponi drumming and dancing, and according to the Mattaponi Heritage Foundation, the tribe will offer prayer to the Great Spirit that the eyes and hearts of our state's leaders will be open to the harm posed by the King William Reservoir. If you'd like more information, Uncle Dennis encourages you to contact the Mattaponi Heritage Foundation. Their number, 804-769-7745, that's 804-769-7745, or the Alliance to Save the Mattaponi, their number, 804-769-4226, that's 804-769-4226, or the local Sierra Club at 804-225-9113, that's 804-225-9113. Other supporters are expected to include Blue Ridge Earth First, as well as Students for the Environmental and Economic Justice and the Student Environmental Action Coalition, both of those affiliated with the College of William and Mary. Once again, February 19th at 1:30 in the afternoon at the Bell Tower on the Capitol Square in Richmond, Virginia. Support the Mattaponi Indian Tribe in their campaign against the King William Reservoir. Sounds like a bummer, and I want to thank Joseph Catron for that article. And here's a chance to help restore the Klamath Basin Wildlife Refuges. For the first time in the history of the Klamath Basin National Wildlife Refuge, the refuge has issued an environmental assessment providing alternatives that would permit commercial agriculture on over 20,000 acres of refuge land if sufficient water is available to maintain wetlands first. Last September, no water was provided to the Lower Klamath National Wildlife Refuge to flood wetlands for migrating waterfowl, despite the fact that an equivalent amount of water needed for wildlife purposes had already been consumed over the summer season to grow non-wildlife beneficial crops such as potatoes, sugar beets, and onions. Furthermore, growing of these and other crops required the application of some 67 pesticide products and formulations, with many identified as having carcinogenic, endocrine-disrupting, or neurotoxic effects. The environmental assessment notes that it is likely, again in 2001, there may not be sufficient water to maintain refuge wetlands. Commercial farming is totally inconsistent with the purposes for which our national wildlife refuges were established. Certainly, the Klamath National Wildlife Refuge should not be trying to maintain a commercial farm program any longer when it has been repeatedly demonstrated throughout the last decade that in dry years, refuge fish and wildlife never have adequate water and thus always suffer. Send your comments as soon as possible to Phil Norton, Refuge Manager, Klamath Basin National Wildlife Refuges, 4009 Hill Road, Tule Lake, California, 96134. Once again, that address, Phil Norton, Refuge Manager, Klamath Basin National Wildlife Refuges, 4009 Hill Road, Tule Lake, California, 96134. As an alternative, you could fax your comments to the refuge headquarters, 630-667-3299. That's 530-667-3299. Please write to the refuge manager, and it was Phil Norton, in support of Alternative 2, that the decision to allow commercial farming should be based on the February 1st and April 1st NRCS forecast, with mid-season irrigation curtailment as refuge wildlife, not agricultural demands require. If you'd like more information on the Klamath Basin National Wildlife Refuges, see the refuge website at www.klamathnwr.org. That's www.klamathnwr.org. If you want more information on this or other Klamath River Basin issues, go to the Oregon Natural Resources Council website, www.onrc.org, and under Current Projects, click on the Coalition for the Klamath Basin. To become a Klamath River Basin Electronic Defender, this is one of those listservs, send an email message with the words, "I want to be a Klamath River Basin Defender," in the body of message to FELICEP at SISQTEL.net. That's FELICEP at SISQTEL.net. Well, unfortunately, that's about all the time we have for news here on Earth First Radio. We're going to have to get to those other bits of news and announcements later on. To get news or announcements from your bioregion to Earth First Radio, send us email at cruiseef at cruiseio.com. That's C-R-U-Z-E-F at C-R-U-Z-I-O.com. Or you can send letters to Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. That's Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. And be sure to send those announcements at least 3 weeks in advance. That's so they get there in time, okay? If you want more in-depth news and information about the Earth First movement, please subscribe to the Earth First Journal. Their current address is P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. That address again is Earth First Journal, P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. You can listen to Earth First Radio live on your computer every Thursday night at 8 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Go to the website www.microradio.net/FRSC. That's www.microradio.net/FRSC. And down, listen right in there. It's an MP3 or Real Audio feed, so should be pretty easy to get. There are lots of great shows available on Free Radio Santa Cruz anytime you want to listen in, and you can always find Earth First Radio archive shows on the World Wide Web at www.radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net, and that's streaming M3 stuff for you technophiles out there. I'd like to mention also that Earth First Radio is rebroadcast on Free Radio Santa Cruz Tuesday mornings at 9 a.m. Earth First Radio is carried on a growing number of free speech and non-commercial radio stations. Please ask your local station to broadcast Earth First Radio. Earth First Radio is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. Our theme music was written and performed by Daryl Cherney from the CD Keep It Wild. I'm Uncle Dennis, and I want to thank you for listening to Earth First Radio. And now we're going to listen to Robert Hoyt off his new CD. The new CD is called Mind's Eye, and this little ditty here is called I Hate Money.
I hate money, I hate the smell of cash. I hate money, we've all got our little stash. I hate money, it's the most addictive stuff. No matter how much you have, it's never enough. I hate money, money killed my brother. I hate money, it's killing my mother. I hate it, look what it's done to you and me. It's not just the root, it's the whole damn tree. I hate money, it's that carrot on a stick. I hate money as I turn another trick. I hate to think that they would take away mine, and that's all it takes to keep me in line. I hate money, money killed my brother. I hate money, it's killing my mother. I hate it, but what it's done to you and me. It's not the root, it's the whole damn tree. So what if we treated it like the trash that it is, and refused to use it to pay for our goods and services? Then this thing money'd become a thing of the past, and any left around it could use to wipe your brow. I hate money, money killed my brother. I hate money, it's killing my mother. I hate it, look what it's done to you and me. It's not just the root, it's the whole damn tree. And I hate that analogy. I hate money, money killed my brother. I hate money.